Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The U.S. Senate approved the immigration bill yesterday on a 68-32 vote. It passed with support from every Democratic senator and 14 Republicans. It's the biggest overhaul of U.S. immigration law since 1986. The 1,200-page measure, called the Border Security, Economic Opportunity, and Immigration Modernization Act, which provides a path to citizenship for millions of undocumented workers, increases H-1B visas for foreign workers, and directs $46 billion to further militarize the U.S.-Mexico border. Color Lines is reporting that immigration advocates were caught off guard when two Republicans introduced an amendment to double the number of agents on the border to 40,000 and build an additional 350 miles of walls and fences. The billions of dollars of new funding will also buy Black Hawk helicopters and drones. A few glaring omissions from most of the reporting are the details and then also the cost, $46 billion. The human element is also missing. This week, Frontline debuted a new documentary focusing on an element of immigration that rarely, if ever, gets attention. Rape in the Fields focuses on the hidden reality of rape on the job for immigrant women working in the fields, factories, and slaughterhouses. Rape in the Fields is a co-production with the Center for Investigative Reporting, the Investigative Reporting Program, and Univision. You can watch the documentary online now, and it debuts on Univision tomorrow night. Today we are joined by Andres Sediel. He is investigative journalist and documentary producer. He's the producer of the new documentary, Rape in the Fields. And Andres and Lowell Bergman worked on a film called Crimes at the Border a couple of years ago that looks at the people who are actually crossing the border. And Andres joins me here in studio. Hi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks. Good morning.
Thanks for coming in. We are also joined by Tim Redmond, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. I say former because Tim recently left the Bay Guardian. He broke the news on a blog he just launched, declaring that after 31 years, quote, "I am no longer with the Bay Guardian. Owner Todd Voigt and I had a major disagreement over personnel and editorial direction, and this is how it ended. I was hoping that if my employment at the paper I have helped build over all these years had to end, it would be on more friendly terms," end quote. In the Progressive magazine, Christopher Cook reports that on June 14th, Redmond was out of a job, removed by the Guardian's new corporate owner after he refused to fire half of the paper's editorial staff. No warning, no thanks, no severance. Christopher Cook reports the news sent shockwaves through the city's progressive communities already embattled by gentrification and displacement. So what happened? What's next for Tim? And what's in store for the future of local independent news? Tim Redmond, former editor of the Bay Guardian. He was there for 31 years. He now has a new blog called Tim's San Francisco. And he joins us in studio. Hi, Tim. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Tim, what did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, actually, I give kudos to a bunch of reporters. I actually thought the Chronicle's coverage, and I'm someone who's been very critical of the San Francisco Chronicle over many years, as you know, as you well know, listeners to the show know. But I thought the way they covered the same-sex marriage decisions showed what a really good daily newspaper in a community that's concerned about an issue can do. They devoted a whole special front page section to it. And, you know, they did what a good newspaper should do. They talked about the legal implications. They talked about the political implications. They talked about the human implications. They talked to people whose lives were going to be changed by this. They even went and talked to James Hormel, who's now 80 years old, who was the first LGBT ambassador in the United States. And they went through that. It was just a package that you really felt like captured what was going on in the city at that moment. And, you know, and it reminded me, you don't see the Cron doing that much. And I realized that they're facing staff shortages like everybody else. But it shows that if they want to put the effort in and they want to put the staff onto it, it's, you know, this kind of thing can be done.
Did they interview any members of the religious communities that oppose gay marriage?
Yeah, they did. And they talked about why, you know, what religious communities are concerned about. And it was an example of what a good daily newspaper can do when they want to. And I walked away thinking, why doesn't the Cron do this every week? Why? I mean, there are so many important issues in San Francisco.
Well, and they do good coverage on a lot of other issues, yeah. Right? Education, the environment, and
they do. But
do you feel like it's not as
well? I feel like with the staff that they have, which granted is less than it used to be, I think they still have enough people that they could pull off and on a more regular basis do this kind of special in-depth stuff where they really take on an issue and try to cover it right.
And I ask about the religious element because NPR had a piece yesterday about balance on gay marriage. Mm. And a lot of people on Facebook noted that minutes after the rulings came down, CNN went to the usual suspects at like the Christian Coalition mm-hmm. and those guys. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on that. After something as historic as this ruling is, do you immediately go, quote, to the other side to get a comment?
Well, you know, obviously, if you're going to be a traditional news media outlet that tries to get all sides of the story, you have to do that. But you don't have to give it equal play. And, you know, it's funny. I talk to journalism students a lot. And I always say, there's at least two sides to every story, but they aren't both right. And, you know, we can talk about this more with your documentary.
Yeah.
But, I mean, what are you going to try to get the other side of whether it's okay to rape immigrant women in the fields? I mean, obviously, there are some things that, in my mind, it's so clear that, yes, there is a increasingly small element of the United States that thinks that same-sex marriage is wrong. It is the polls are going overwhelmingly in the other direction. You have to acknowledge that. But I don't think you have to say that those two things are on equal footing.
I mean, you definitely want to try to get all sides. In our film, we definitely went to the alleged perpetrators to get their mm-hmm. side of the story. We went to the companies that were being sued because we want to see it from as many angles as we can. You're absolutely right. It doesn't mean you get equal play. It's the same with the discussion of climate change. I mean, there is a vocal minority that you want to hear what they have to say, but it doesn't mean that they get as much time as everybody else does.
All right. So kudos to the Chronicle for their coverage of the historic Supreme Court rulings this week. And Andres, what about you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I definitely have to send a shout out to my colleagues at the Center for Investigative Reporting. Bernice Young and Grace Rubenstein did a great job. They were reporting this Rape in the Fields project with me for the last year. You can see their reporting online on the Frontline website, the CRI website, and in Spanish on the Univision website as well. And this was a really hard story to do. I mean, this is a situation where the first question we get asked is, how big a problem is this? And what we find immediately is there's no statistics. I mean, we're talking about mostly an undocumented population. The Department of Labor, their best estimates of how many people are out there, they don't even know, and they're admitting they don't know. So when you take a population that's basically invisible, and then you talk about something like sexual assault, which just across the board is underreported. There aren't a lot of statistics. There aren't women going and reporting this to the judge or to the police officer, to the sheriff. There aren't any numbers. So as an investigative reporting team, you're trying to figure out, well, how big is the scope? Where do you start? I mean, obviously, and they did a great job, and we were out there talking to women out there in the fields, trying to find as many anecdotal stories as we could. But then what they did that nobody else had done up to this point is they did an in-depth analysis of all the federal civil lawsuits for sexual harassment in the fields, and they broke them down in terms of how many of the women had been sexually assaulted versus sexual harassment, how many involved retaliation, and how many criminal prosecutions had resulted of all this. In the end, the answer was none. No criminal prosecutions associated with any of the mm-hmm. civil lawsuits involving sexual assault.
Well, okay, so since you brought this up, let's talk about this documentary that debuted on Frontline this week. You can watch it online, Rape in the Fields, and it debuts on Univision. It'll be in Spanish tomorrow night. How did you come to take on this project? I mean, how did you get the idea to do this?
I mean, this is one of those great stories. Working at the investigative reporting program at the Graduate School of Journalism, UC Berkeley, we get to work with a lot of graduate students. And there was a woman who, as part of her summer internship, was working on a story in North Carolina. I think it was might have been a salmonella story at a chicken facility or something along those lines. And she was talking to one of the women who worked there, and she realized this woman, you know, she had 7 or 8 kids or something like that. But they weren't her husband's kids. They were the foreman's kids. And as she was talking to this woman, she realized that this was a deal that they had arranged. It was a form of job security for her. Now, she came back with this story, and it kind of blew our minds. And, you know, she was given some time and resources, and it turned out to be her thesis. And she found out that this was happening all over the place. We took her thesis, which in the end we realized was just scratching the surface, and we kept it around the shop for 3 or 4 years until this opportunity to collaborate with Frontline Univision came up. And that was an opportunity that we couldn't miss. I mean, we brought this story to them. Everybody was very excited, and we had the backing of two organizations to do this in English, where hopefully it'll have an impact with a lot of the growers and the policymakers, and then in Spanish, where a lot of the victims are going to see it.
Right. What happens when you get an idea I mean, what's so great about Frontline is I'm looking at your website right now. You've got documentaries on retirement, Syria, Pakistan, Top Secret America, just so many different topics. Can you just talk about the process involved? Because a year-long investigation is... doesn't really happen these days anymore.
Oh, no, it was very luxurious. And I have to say that it took that long to do this story. I mean, we're talking about trying to get women who, again, most of them maybe not here legally, talking about something that a lot of personal shame involved. They don't want their husbands to find out. They don't want their family to find out. They don't. Why would they ever want to put their face on national television? So it took a year for us to get some of these people to commit and to go on camera. So without that backing, I don't think this could have been done. Frontline has a great reputation because they take on these hard stories, they dedicate the time and the resources, and they do it really well. So it was a great opportunity to be able to work with them on that. I think what we end up doing is we are always piggybacking on our previous reporting. So now the next question I'm getting, you know, five times a day is, what's your next story? Well, I need to, you know, think about this for a little while because I have 10 possible stories that have come out of this. I mean, you can't crisscross the country and talk to farm working women in the middle of an immigration debate and not have 10 stories in your back pocket.
Exactly. And Tim, this just shows why investigative reporting is so important, because these most of these women, if not all of them, right, have never spoken publicly before. Some of them are on camera blacked out, but a lot of them are there for you to see. And so when I watched this and I thought, this is why we need investigative journalism.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's more and more rare because people don't want to devote the money to it. I mean, you know, what we're seeing increasingly is you're not seeing NBC do this. You're not even seeing the New York Times do this kind of thing. What you're seeing is it's coming out of the nonprofits. It's coming out of ProPublica. It's coming out of the Center for Investigative Reporting. It's coming out of Frontline. These are all not traditional corporate for-profit entities because, and the reason that ProPublica, for example, exists, and the reason that CIR exists, is that the big media outlets on every front, print, broadcast, they're cutting back, particularly on investigative reporting. It's expensive. It costs a lot of money to spend a year working on a project like this. And if, but without that, without those resources, this kind of story never gets told.
Did you have to really go to bat for this issue? Or did you say, look, we've got these women who will talk, and did Frontline give you the green light? How does that work?
Well, first of all, we didn't have the women who were going to talk. So that was, Frontline and Univision Stone were always behind the story. I mean, they believed in the story. They let us, you know, we did start off with a reporting phase. So we got a reporting budget, and we went out into the fields and spent, I guess it was last summer into the harvest season, and to really see if this was viable. And I think the thing that we knew immediately is that there's a story here. There are women. This is serious. There's something happening here. But we didn't have women on camera. So that was, you know, it was a leap of faith for us and for the institutions to continue backing us as we kept looking for those women to come forward. And when we did, it was just what we needed.
Let's hear a clip, a trailer from the documentary Rape in the Fields. It was reported by Lowell Bergman, produced by today's guest, Andres Sediel.
These are the women.
We found really bad situations with ongoing sexual violence.
Who pick and process.
They were all illegal and they were afraid they were going to get deported.
The food on our tables.
Dije no más, no más.
Frontline, in collaboration with Univision and CIR, investigate Rape in the Fields. Watch online or on air beginning June 25th.
And it debuts again on Univision tomorrow night. What were the challenges in spending a year on a story like this?
Oh, well, there are many challenges. But again, I think that in this case, the story was always there in the sense that you just needed to have some people to put their face to the issue. I mean, I mentioned the issues before about having lack of statistics, but then you need these personal testimonies. It was really spending time with people, looking through every farming community in the country. I mean, we were up in the Yakima Valley in Washington State. We were in Iowa. We went to Florida. We were up in down California from Huron to Lemoore to Firebaugh to Madera to Wooddale, to Woodland to Oakdale, to say nothing of Salinas and Fresno. We were, and a lot of that had to do with just finding somebody to come forward. Because everywhere we went, there were stories. And we did many interviews with women in shadow. And we heard the same stories everywhere we went. But it was just until we found, in this case, we found a woman in Salinas named Maricruz Ladino, who put her face to the camera. And that was really the game changer for us.
How did you gain trust? Did you have any women working behind the camera?
I hired mostly women to work with me.
Okay.
In every instance where we did an interview of a sexual assault victim, there was a woman doing the interview, and there was a Spanish-speaking woman. And so that's how, that was one of the just styles of how we did this. We had a Stephanie Matura was a fantastic editor. She was our woman editor, and I had a woman associate producer. We had lots of women around for obvious reasons. But what we found, and especially when it comes to having people come forward, they have to be really to come forward to everybody, because they have to be able to come forward because their husbands are going to see it, the judge is going to see it, the perpetrator. So really, when these women had developed enough courage to come forward, it didn't really matter if they were talking to a man or a woman. They were telling their story.
And Tim, what are your thoughts on the state of reporting on these issues? I mean, we're in the middle of it here, right? The bread basket is in the Central Valley. And agriculture is so strong in this state. And so what are your thoughts on the state of reporting on these important issues?
Well, you know, there was a time when the Santa Rosa Press Democrat had a full-time reporter covering nothing but immigration issues. And that was in the days when the New York Times owned it. I actually know Martin Espinoza used to work for me. He was their immigration reporter. And they decided that it was important enough in that community to have somebody doing this full-time. You don't see that as much anymore. You certainly, in fact, the Chronicle, you just don't, you know, even the major dailies around the Bay Area, even the LA Times, it's not as if this is considered the most important beat that we have to be on all the time. And I think that's kind of sad. I mean, you think about this. I mean, it's a brilliant story you got onto, but this has been going on for how many years?
Oh, it's been going on for generations.
For generations.
Dolores Huerta talks about how her mother wouldn't allow her to work in the fields because of this.
Exactly. I mean, this has been going on for a long, long time, and not in any way demeaning the work that you did, but you think, how could this have been going on for generations? And until a journalism student picked up on this doing a different story and it got to somebody like you who recognized the importance of it, this has never been reported. I mean, that's kind of, in a sense, again, I'm really glad you did this and it's great, but in a sense, one of the questions you have to ask is, why is it taking this long to come out?
Well, I mean, there's lots of answers to why it's taking so long. And I think looking forward for me, when I think about this this bill that just got passed in the proposed 13 years path to citizenship, I think to myself, well, there's 13 years of stories.
Yeah,
you know, you could start
absolutely
following somebody now and see what happens. And, you know, this isn't going away. And in fact, I think what's the opportunity for journalists is one of the reasons why it's very hard to report the story we just did is because people are hiding. I think what I didn't realize until I started working on this is that when these people get up in the morning, long before the sun comes up, and go out to work, they don't know if they're coming back. Mm-hmm. They don't know if they're going to see their families when they get home. They don't know when the raid's going to come. So they're living in fear and as criminals in the shadows, and they don't want to speak out and tell their stories. So now that we are starting to see some reform, it seems to me that some of these people are going to start coming out. We're going to start to hear more and more what's been going on in America.
You report just one example about the egg facility. What was the name of that?
The DeCoster.
DeCoster.
Yeah.
Where when immigration officials would show up, officials in the factory would lock the doors. And sometimes the kid's mom wouldn't come home for 3 days. And the women told you that they would have to sleep in cardboard boxes. And then lawyers told you they fed them scrambled eggs.
Yeah, no, this is one of those stories where the folks who were smuggling the workers here from indigenous villages in Mexico would take them to work in these egg processing plants in Iowa. And they were basically, in some cases, they were literally being held captive. They didn't want to get raided, so they would lock them up. They knew that if they were going back and forth from work, they could get picked up by ICE, who was patrolling the area. So they locked them up in just inhumane conditions. And it's like you said, their families were at home wondering where they were. And it turned out that these same women who were being locked up were also being sexually assaulted, pretty systematically is what it sounds like by the supervisors.
That is Andres Sediel. He is producer of the new documentary Rape in the Fields. You can watch it online now, and it debuts on Univision in Spanish tomorrow night. We're also joined by Tim Redmond, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. He just left the Bay Guardian, or was ousted. Is that the right way to say it, Tim?
Well, you know, honestly, we could have this kind of fine line debate, but the reality is I had a significant dispute with the current management and left. And, you know, how that exactly came down isn't really relevant, doesn't really matter at this point. The point is I realized that I was no longer going to be able to work at The Guardian.
After 31 years at the San Francisco Bay Guardian, and we'd love to hear from you, Tim's decision to leave The Guardian has received a lot of attention over the last couple of weeks. And then also, we'd love to hear from you on immigration. This is getting wall-to-wall coverage. The Senate approved the bill yesterday, 68-32. It's the biggest overhaul of U.S. immigration laws since 1986. So what are your thoughts on the coverage? Do you see the human element in any of the coverage? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So let's talk about this immigration bill, a 1,200-page measure. We've been reading Washington Post, New York Times, LA Times this morning, and most of the media say it'll give billions more dollars to securing the border. Well, I had to search high and low until I found in the Washington Post that it's actually $46 billion. I mean, that's a significant number. Andres, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a lot of money. My first question is for what? And speaking of some other reporting that the New York Times had done a couple weeks back, there's a video online by my colleague Brent McDonald where they basically went to go talk to Border Patrol, and their reaction was, actually, you know what? We're good. We have a lot of money. We have fences. We have drones. We got jeeps. We got border agents. I think we're okay. We don't really need all this extra money if you're going to send it to us. But then my question would be, what is the actual impact of building the fence? Some of the reporting that Lowell Bergman and I had done a few years back on a Frontline World piece called Crimes at the Border, we were looking at people who are being smuggled across the U.S.-Mexican border. And as the fence gets longer, it gets more difficult to cross. That's true. But people are still going to come. And what happens is they end up paying smugglers to get them across and dealing with criminal cartels to get them across. And they come. And they still come. And whether they come and they get caught and they get sent back, they just dump them back in Tijuana. They can't go home to their village. They have to try again, two times, three times. And after three tries, University of San Diego study said that 98% of them will get across.
And human rights organizations report that women also get raped in the fields coming to the U.S.
Oh, we heard
in the desert.
Yeah, exactly.
Say.
So, for instance, we talked to women. I mean, one of the questions that came up in our reporting is, if you're being raped at work, why aren't you complaining, or why didn't you come forward before? And one of the things we heard is, at that point, that was the least of their problems. They had already been sexually assaulted when they made a lot of sacrifices to come here. We heard stories of women who, as part of their crossing the border travel kit, bring condoms in the hope that if they get raped, at least they're not going to get HIV or get pregnant. So sexual assault for these women is something that they're coming from. They have a lifetime of it already by the time they get here.
That is Andres Sediel. He is producer of the new documentary Rape in the Fields. And you can watch it online now. You can find it on our Facebook page or search for it. And then it'll debut on Univision tomorrow. It looks at the hidden reality of rape on the job for immigrant women working in the fields and factories. We're also joined by Tim Redmond, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. He was there for 31 years. And he is now blogging at his new blog called Tim's San Francisco. And after the break, we will talk about the state of local independent journalism. And we'd love to hear from you. What is it like in your area? Where do you go for local news? And then also, we'd love to hear from you on media coverage of immigration. It's your call. We'll be back after this.
All of the stories that you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org, and they're also included in the weekly email newsletter that's easy to sign up for. It's free as well. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. If you'd like to join in this morning's conversation and highlight the reporting that you thought was valuable this week, the number to call is 866-798-8255. 866-798-TALK.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll get the latest from the front lines of the battle for reproductive rights. If you've been following what's happening in Texas, there was a bill that would have shut down all but five clinics in the state. There was a filibuster, 11-hour filibuster, and the Democrats successfully stopped the vote from happening. Well, Governor Rick Perry says we've got to vote again, and they're going to go back to the Capitol on Monday, July 1st, for a special session. So we will check in with activists in more conservative parts of the country to find out what they're facing and how they are working to defend the constitutional right to abortion. Tuesday, we will talk about the legacy of Nelson Mandela. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Andres Sediel. He is producer of the Frontline documentary, Rape in the Field, reported by Lowell Bergman. You can watch it online now. It looks at the hidden reality of rape on the job for immigrant women working in this country. We're also joined by Tim Redmond, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. He's no longer there after 31 years of reporting on local politics. He now has a new blog called Tim's San Francisco. And we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we've got a question about local reporting. Let's hear from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes, good morning. I think that the local reporting in general is pretty execrable. The Bay Citizen died, and there was no coverage whatsoever of that. I've been trying to get some information about the privatization of 55 acres of Golden Gate Park at the San Francisco Botanical Gardens' Thriving Arboretum. In the news media, there's been a total blackout. I was able to get an op-ed online with the Bay Guardian, and then I was told by another reporter that evidently they don't believe it's necessary to cover it in the other publications since that was already there. I don't know how much it could possibly cost to hire a reporter given the fact that this guy Todd Vaught, a Canadian, had the money to bring in Michelle Schacht for a free concert that was canceled and also have a whole thing in the SF Weekly about this an article about this when it's not really of any consequence whatsoever compared to the major local issues that are happening here. When I got an op-ed a few years ago in the Chronicle, Lois Kazakoff cut out the part about the San Francisco Botanical Garden Society paying a lobbyist, Sam Lauter, to lobby for the fees, even though I had evidence without consulting me. When you call the Chronicle News Desk, generally you get a recorded line. And I think that it seems like we have a huge problem here in that the editorial boards seem to be more and more deciding what the reporters are going to cover. And they think that Todd Vaught seems to want to turn the Bay Guardian into this sort of libertarian, neoliberal rag for hipsters who eat at restaurants that cost $100 a person.
Well, thank you for calling, Harry. You brought up a number of points there. Just to let people know, Harry is a local activist who spends a lot of time looking at the privatization of the parks and really tries to raise awareness about all the different interests that are involved in the parks. So on that issue, where do you go for information about, like, fees at the Arboretum, for example?
Well, that's tough. I mean, The Guardian has spent a lot of time talking about privatization in the parks in general. But, you know, one of the things that struck me is what Harry said about calling the Chronicle and getting a recorded line at the news desk. I mean, you know, one of the things that I think is really important for local media is to be accountable, to answer your phone. This is one of the things I've always joked people about. I answer my phone. I don't have somebody blocking the calls. I always did it, you know, for 31 years at The Guardian. You dial the number that's published in the paper, and I pick up and say hello. And I think that that's something that's really important because, you know, we need to hear from people like Harry, who is obviously not satisfied with the coverage. Now, he and I could disagree over whether this issue is more important than another one, but I think it's important for the media to be listening to people like this who have, you know, people like Harry who've got an issue that they think is really important.
And really do their homework.
Yeah.
So the other question is, can you talk about the owner of the San Francisco Bay Guardian? And what do these corporate interests want out of local papers? I mean, are they making money?
It's an interesting question. I think now, I think that what Todd Vogt has in mind is looking at that old word synergy. I think he is looking at how if you right now and the reality is that print newspapers are in trouble all over the country. And a lot of them are folding. In fact, it's true in the alternative press, too. The Boston Phoenix, one of the most famous, one of the earliest, one of the best alternative newspapers in the history of the United States, folded recently. The alternative newspaper in Honolulu folded recently. And I think what Todd is looking at is not trying to speak for him, but I think the idea is, well, these newspapers can't make it on their own. Maybe if we try to put two or three of them together and use the sales synergy and so forth, maybe we can keep some of these papers alive. And of course, he's a business person. And I think he's also thinking that there's still money to be made in print, which honestly, not a lot of people are thinking these days. So, you know, Todd is kind of unusual in that sense. He still thinks that you can make money off of newspapers. So it's an interesting trend. And it really does go to, you know, what's going on with print media and what's going on with the alternative press in the United States when, as I say, in the last year, we've lost two large alternative weeklies, including the Boston Phoenix. And, you know, you look at the Village Voice, which was the king of all of us. I mean, the Village Voice was the first. It was the landmark. It was the one. And the Village Voice is down to almost nothing now.
So once these new owners come in, what changes do you see at these papers?
Well, it depends. I mean, the big story in the alternative press in the last couple decades was the growth of the Village Voice Media New Times chain, where basically what happened was, not to go on too long, but a lot of these papers were started in the 60s and 70s by idealistic people who just wanted to start a newspaper to stick it to the man and fight the powers that be and be against the Vietnam War. And a lot of them, you know, in retrospect, a lot of them probably should have set up as nonprofits. But they weren't thinking that way because no one thought about nonprofit journalism in 1966. So they set them up as small businesses. And low about the 1980s, they started to make a lot of money. And all of a sudden, the alternative papers that were out there fighting the system were making millions and millions of dollars in some cities, New York, for example, and Phoenix and Denver and Houston. And at that point, people like Goldman Sachs started to take notice. And some of these investors started looking at how do we build these into bigger chains? And at one point, you know, Village Voice Media, which included the former Phoenix New Times chain, had like 17 alternative weeklies. And what they did was they set them up in a very systematic, structured way. Every paper is going to look the same, and every editor is going to have the same basic approach, and all the HR is going to be exactly the same, and we're going to look at these as money-making machines, and they were. And now, we're kind of on a curve where a lot of the money coming into the alternative press came from classifieds. That's gone. A lot of it came from ads that are now going onto the web, and a lot of our readers, frankly, are now looking to the web first and to print second. So now it's kind of all up in the air, and I think you're seeing more and more around the country people saying, "Wow, how are we going to make this work?" And I think that's kind of what Todd's idea was. Well, we put this together, and maybe we can keep it going.
And so now you've got this the same corporation. Is it right to call it a corporation?
Or I think it's an LLC.
Okay,
yeah. That's a corporation. Yeah.
So a corporation owning the Examiner, the Weekly, and the Bay Guardian.
Yes. That is exactly what's going on.
Rob wants to know who owns the East Bay Express now.
The East Bay Express is independently owned, and it's owned by some investors who put it together. And they're still a completely independent paper. And, you know, they, like all of the independents, I think are struggling. They're doing okay, but it's not like the old days where you could just say, okay, as an independent, I'm making enough money to not only pay the staff, but to make a little profit and to keep everybody happy. It's a challenge.
What about neighborhood papers? Rob also says that he likes the Richmond Review.
Well, you know, the neighborhood papers are one of the hidden successes of San Francisco journalism. These neighborhood papers not only are doing a good job covering the neighborhoods, but they actually seem to be doing okay financially because they've got that very specific market base where you can say, you know, if you pick up the Noe Valley Voice, every realtor in Noe Valley advertises in it, every supermarket, every liquor store, they've just got those. And the challenge is, though, they don't have enough revenue to hire much of a full-time reporting staff. So they're mostly done by volunteers and or people who are getting paid a little bit of money. So it's not quite the level that you would hope to see in terms of professional reporting, but they're doing a great job for the neighborhoods.
Andres, as a documentary producer, where do you go for local news? You live in the East Bay.
That's true. I mean, for my local news, I'm a big fan of local television coverage. I mean, it's sometimes hard to watch. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. But those reporters and journalists, they work so hard. I don't know if people realize how hard television journalists who produce news every day work, going out there, filing their stories, working on telling you what's going on. I'm a big fan of KTVU. But I think what I'd like to talk about, I mean, when you talk about the demise of newspapers, there's also the demise of the big television news networks, and the budgets there are falling as well, and have been for a while. I mean, to be able to have done this piece with Frontline Univision and the amount of resources we are given is very uncommon nowadays. So while we've all been bemoaning the shrinking budgets, there are some bright spots, and I'm very encouraged and excited to hear what's going to happen and to pay attention to what's going to happen with Al Jazeera America, which is on a big hiring spree in hiring people all over the country. They have their bureau in Washington and D.C., and now they have one here in San Francisco, and to see what that's going to do in terms of getting more journalists out there working, doing good coverage. Univision, they're partnering with ABC and starting an English language network, Fusion. And they're also on a similar hiring spree. And there is hope out there in terms of getting journalists jobs, which means keeping the public more informed.
You know, it's interesting that you actually give kudos to TV local news, because it's easy to write off television because of the cable stations. I mean, that's one reason why I got rid of my television, because I couldn't help but watching the screaming matches. And then I started to scream and I thought, well, this isn't helping anything. But I think cable gives television overall a very bad rap. But then local news also gets a bad rap because, as you said, a lot of it is if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah, no, local news gets a really bad rap. And I think it's important to pay attention to what's going on in your local news, because they are doing stories that other people aren't doing. They have reporters who are out there on the scene talking to people and interviewing folks in the neighborhoods. So I think it's really important to be paying attention to what's going on local television news. Cable, that's harder to talk to. I mean, I spend a lot of time on the road and in hotel rooms and watching cable news. And it's become increasingly difficult to find anything worthwhile.
They actually got slammed last week. I think it was the Thursday night. A lot of us were up late watching the 11-hour filibuster by Texas State Senator Wendy Davis. And it was all over Twitter and all over Facebook, and the cable shows were nowhere to be found. In fact, NBC News tweeted, "What's going on, Twitter? What's happening in Texas?" And then that got a lot of coverage. Like, are you kidding me? This is huge, and you're not covering it.
Yeah, well, I think that's the kind of thing that you see happen, because they probably didn't have CNN wasn't ready. They didn't know this was going to happen in advance. And what happens when you cut newsroom budgets is you can't respond to things as quickly. You know, I mean, I think going back to the Chronicle, we all knew in advance when the same-sex marriage decision was going to come down. You had time to gear up. You had time to put this together and plan it. All right, maybe it was going to come Monday. Maybe it was going to come Tuesday, but we knew it was going to come. When something really unexpected happens, you know, it used to be that the big newspapers, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, all had a bureau chief in every community. And there would be somebody on the scene to run right to the state capitol and watch that. And the TV stations, NBC would have somebody right on the scene, an affiliate who could just instantly go out there and cover this. And I think we're not seeing that as much anymore. So it's interesting you talk about Twitter, because what's happening now is, of course, a lot of this stuff, a lot of people now, instead of going to your local KTVU News, which I also have always liked, instead of turning on KTVU at night, you go to Facebook and you go to Twitter and you go to whatever online outlet you're looking at and look for them, in part because you don't have to wait till 10 o'clock. You could just get it whenever. But the economic model isn't there yet, so they don't hire reporters. Mm-hmm. You know, the very successful online news sites like Daily Kos, for example, and Wonkat, which is kind of ironic, but the big online news sites don't have reporters. They have people picking up on other reporters' work and training. So that's where you get this kind of challenge. Who is there to run off to the Texas legislature and start covering this? Who's filming it? Who's around? I think that's one of the things that we're missing.
Yeah, a great Texas blog, it's escaping me now, but I want to give it credit, was covering this nonstop and tweeting about it. They don't have a paper, but they do, they're online.
Yeah.
I'll find that in a couple minutes. Today we're joined by Tim Redmond, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. He was there for 31 years and now runs a blog called Tim San Francisco. We're also joined by Andres Sediel. He's producer of the new Frontline documentary, Rape in the Fields. It looks at the hidden reality of rape on the job for immigrant women working in the fields in our own backyard. And we'd love to hear from you if you have a comment on local reporting. Where do you go for local news? What does it take to build a local successful institution? And we've got a couple emails on immigration. If you'd like to talk about that, you can give us a call, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Chris in San Francisco. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose and Tim. This is Chris, San Francisco. And first, I want to thank Tim Redmond for his amazing 30 years of experience of commitment and great work at The Guardian, and just say I think it's a real shame. A lot of us feel like it's a real shame that you got ousted or edged out, whatever the right word is. But kudos to you for your great work. And I guess I just wanted to raise a pretty widespread concern about how do communities that have been long ignored by media and progressive issues that have long been ignored, how do they now get covered when we have these sort of editorial and advertising synergies going on? And we don't know exactly where they're going to go with The Guardian, but the talk is of changing the, you know, the tone and changing the audience that they appeal to. And at what point does that lead to a diminution of coverage of progressive voices?
Well, and Chris, we should say this is Christopher Cook, who wrote about what happened with Tim at the Progressive magazine. Chris, you're an independent journalist in San Francisco. If you find a story about, say, one of the new high-rise condominiums that's being built in San Francisco and you want to write about it, where do you go? Is there an outlet, and can you get paid for that kind of reporting?
Well, the first answer is yes, there are outlets. The second answer is to get paid is increasingly difficult as an independent journalist or even as a staffer now. So, you know, there are plenty of publications. The Bay Guardian is still around, and they're still doing some good work for now. And there's the Public Press, which is a wonderful paper that I've written for, and they're exploring a sort of NPR-style nonprofit model. But they don't have the resources to pay people very much, if anything, usually. And so they eke out some great work on the margins. And then at that point, you're dealing with, for local media, you're dealing with The Chronicle and The Examiner, and I don't know if The Examiner even pays anyway. Mm. But, you know, it's exceedingly difficult unless you can build it into a national story of some kind.
Yeah.
You know, even then, the national landscape for pay for journalists has become generally quite wretched.
Let me thank you, Chris, by the way. Thank you very much for all your kind words. Let me make a wild prediction here, okay? 10 years from now, there are going to be 5 online daily newspapers in San Francisco. The Chronicle is going to continue to decline. This is my optimistic prediction. This is what I think the possibly good news that we can look at is. You know, I think that the model of the old-fashioned newsroom where you had 300 reporters in a big cavernous space and a big daily newspaper that dominated what went on in the city every day and every week is declining. I mean, I think that's almost gone, and it's going to continue to decline. But I think in its place, someone is going to figure out the economic model to have a online newsroom with 10 reporters instead of 200. But there'll be a bunch of them, and maybe the good news is maybe we'll be heading back to the days when you had a whole bunch of competing daily newspapers in town, none of them gigantic, none of them dominant, some of them from a left perspective, some of them from a more conservative perspective, kind of competing for readers' attention. And I'll also say that I do think that the nonprofit model is what's happening in journalism now. I mean, I think that some of these may end up being, and this is not just San Francisco, I think around the country, some of these may end up being nonprofits. Some of them may end up being small businesses that are looking to, you know, use advertising and sponsorships and whatever else that they can get. But I kind of see it going that way because I've always said that democracy cannot survive without reporters. Mm-hmm. I mean, we cannot have a functioning democracy in the United States of America unless we have people like Lowell Bergman going out and exposing what's wrong, and unless we have daily newspaper reporters telling people what their government is doing and what corporations are doing to them. And doing, you just can't have a democracy. So I think that model is going to have to evolve.
What are your thoughts on that, Andres?
Oh, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that it's going to have to evolve. I mean, it is evolving. I think the trick is really, as you point out, it's the economic model. How are we going to make this work? I mean, talking about it from the documentary filmmaker perspective, again, it's the same kind of thing. There's plenty of outlets out there. I mean, there's always YouTube. I mean, there's lots of ways to get your story out there. It's just whether you're going to get paid. You're going to put the video on your blog. It's going to go on the Huffington Post. Or can you get an institution to put some money into it? But, you know, you're talking about covering the filibuster in Texas. Yeah, they may not have an affiliate there anymore. There's not the infrastructure to be able to deploy somebody. But I bet there's a freelancer there. And I bet the freelancer will do it for cheap, too. So then that's what we see, as the price of equipment gets for cameras and microphones gets cheaper and cheaper. You can literally get it done for cheaper and cheaper, but then people just don't get paid.
Well, the other problem is that there's so many great nonprofits now. ProPublica, California Watch, so many. David Talbot from Salon is starting his own, and he says that they're getting funding and they're probably going to get the green light to move forward. But how do you elevate these stories? Because we have these great reporters on who are, frankly, not on the cable shows. Their stuff isn't really being shared on Facebook. And so how do you elevate, how do you elevate rape in the fields? Because I noticed that this debuted right before the filibuster took off on Twitter. And the Texas thing was getting so much attention. And how do you elevate something like this documentary?
I mean, I think what we were able to do, and I think what you have to do, especially when you're working in the nonprofit model and you're trying to reach it to a wide audience, I mean, it's fantastic what local papers are doing, but if you're going to have a broader reach, you have to partner up with national partners. So, I mean, in this case, for our story, it wasn't just Frontline and Univision. Excuse me, KQED was involved, Center for Investigative Reporting, the IRP. You just start partnering with everybody you can. I think gone are the days where we didn't want somebody else to beat us, right? It's now, how can we keep on getting the story out in as many different ways as possible? CIR created a multimedia graphic novel that they're getting out there. We're having different radio stories, as many videos up on the web as we can, and it's more about blanketing the media landscape as much as possible, and you just got to go for it.
Yeah, and I think what you said about not worrying about, somebody else is going to get the story before us is so important, because we are in a different media landscape. And now it's a question of, we've got the story, what can we do with it? And, the good news is that it doesn't have to be NBC, CBS, or ABC. At this point, there was a time when you could do the best documentary in the world, it could be on Frontline. But if the big guys, if the New York Times and the three big networks didn't pick it up, nobody heard about it. Or only a smaller number of people heard about it. Nowadays, actually, through social media and through the web, you can get that story out to millions and millions of people, even if the big networks ignore it. So that's the positive side of this.
We have an email from, let me find this, Nick, who says, my instinctive reaction as to why this important story has not gotten out until now, agribusiness is the strongest vested interest in California, and the Latino voting bloc is stronger than ever. A new threshold has been reached. What are your thoughts, Andres?
Well, I mean, it's true that agribusiness, especially in California, has all kinds of political influence. It was really disappointing for us that we weren't able to get more representatives from the agribusiness in our documentary.
We got one.
He was the one who made it to the screen. But we did try to talk to John Harris, who was involved in one of our big cases from Harris Ranch and other growers, because we wanted to hear their perspective. I mean, this is a situation. I mean, if there's one thing that I have learned on this project is that agriculture is. It's so a part of all of our everyday lives that we're not paying attention to in terms of not just the food we eat, but the resources of the state from water and labor, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a lot of stories there in agriculture. And the fact that now that more and more people are feeling empowered to speak out in the Latino community with the possibility of being documented here, I think we're going to see more and more of these stories.
And Nick also says, thanks for having Tim on the show, the most courageous editor in the Bay Area.
Well, thank you so much.
And we have an email from Valerie who says, the immigration bill started okay and has only gotten worse. 13 years as a path to citizenship seemed too long, in my opinion, and now with increased funding for so-called border security. I feel this is money for contractors. We can't increase funding for food stamps, but the Congress can increase funds for border control. I'm also concerned about the local animal populations and how they will be affected by the continuation of this fence. Do you know anything about this, Andres?
Well, I mean, there's so many issues with the fence that could be a whole other topic. I don't think that there's people are really clear on what it means to put a fence across 1,000 miles of the desert. And there's not just the animals and the migrating patterns. There's different land claims. There's private property. There's Indian reservations. I mean, when you put a wall, what has always been, geographically, it's a fluid area, and it has been for a long time. And what I think a lot of people don't realize who haven't spent time on the border is that it's really a virtual border. I mean, if you're down in Tijuana, there's people commuting into the United States for the day to work, and they go back home at the end of the day. There's people who are driving down to Tijuana to do their shopping. They're coming back. It's really just a toll booth. I'm not sure that anybody really knows what the purpose of the wall really is.
And again, the funding, $46 billion missing from most reports. What are your thoughts on the language here? A lot of reports say secure, and then some of the more progressive, like color lines, say militarize.
Well, I would even just start with the word secure. Secure from what? Is this a security threat? What is the secure? If it is a security threat, what are we securing against? I haven't seen anything to suggest that there's terrorists that are coming across the U.S.-Mexico border. So what is the security about? I would start with that. Militarization, I mean, if you want to use that word, I think the idea would be to start point at some specifics that would justify the use of that term. Is that because you're using drones that are also being used by the military? Is it because is there any crossover between the technologies that the Border Police are using and the Department of Defense? I think it'd be really interesting instead of talking about the choice of the words, but what are the facts that justify that term?
Right, and a lot of reports say high technology without including the fact that drones will be used.
Absolutely, because it's easier and simpler, and you don't have to do that reporting. You can just say, you can quote Congress. The simple, easy, lazy journalistic thing to do is to quote somebody in Congress saying, we're going to secure the border, and not take the time to go out there and say, wait, what does that really mean? Not only secure it from whom, but how? And in fact, you know, we should not be afraid to use the term militarization of the border if that is in fact accurate, and increasingly it is. The other thing we should not be afraid to talk about is that a lot of this money, as Andre said, the Border Patrol says we're good, we've got this. Who's going to get that money? Where is that money actually going to go to? And I think one of the emailers said it's going to go to private contractors. I think that's a lot of what's going to go on, because increasingly, military work in the United States is farmed out to private contractors. And we all know the problems with that. There are a tremendous number of problems with that. So I think that those are two things that, you know, the privatization of border security and or militarization are words we should not be afraid to use.
And 5 seconds, Tim, on your new blog, you're going to continue covering local politics.
I'm going to continue covering local politics and this and who knows what else.
All right. And we'll definitely have you back to talk about that. Tim Redman, former editor of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. His new blog is Tim's San Francisco. Andres Sediel is producer of the documentary Rape in the Fields. Be sure to check it out online tomorrow night on Univision. Thank you for joining us. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. What's the latest from the front lines of the battle for reproductive rights? On the next Your Call, we'll speak with activists about the state of the pro-choice movement. From Texas to Virginia, Republican legislators have been passing laws to make it incredibly difficult to have an abortion. So who are the activists working to defend this right? What are they learning that the broader pro-choice movement needs to know? And where have they won victories? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.